Today, as many of us in this Hudson City community are aware, and the Columbia County community for that matter, we are celebrating at the same time mourning the loss of our sister Christina Malisoff. And I put some songs together that have to do with my experiences with Christina. It may not be those of other people, but when I decided I wanted to do something today to celebrate her life, I thought of songs that have to do with the conversations that we've had and the way we knew each other, the way we did simpatico with each other, and those kinds of things. Christina, to me, was the professional's professional person who gave a lot of her life and effort and inspiration to many people in many venues in this county. Her fight against cancer was one that many of us who will remember her will never forget. So without too much ado, I just want to start by playing some songs here that have to do with passing over. And I'll be reminding people, as you may be tuning in over the course of my program, that what we're doing today is celebrating the life of, I am celebrating my experience with the life of Christina Malisoff.
Sam, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm okay.
We got a room full of people here today.
We certainly do. It's getting hot in the WGXC studios. We are on the tail end of a 14-hour homelessness marathon. If you go to homelessness.org, you can find out more about what happened over the course of the night and evening. And this morning, we're doing our own little mini homeless marathon. We've got Paul Mossman, Commissioner of Social Services, here with us as a guest. We also have Tina Sharp, who is the Executive Director of Columbia Opportunities. And we also have Susan Cody. She is a Residential Division Director of Mental Health of Columbia and Greene Counties. And we actually have phone-ins with Mark Dunley from Hunger Action Network. Holy mackerel, that was a lot to say.
Wow. All right, coming right up is the environment report, and then all these interviews. We also wanted to mention the passing this weekend of our dear friend Christina Malisoff. Age 56, passed away after a long battle with cancer, April 19th at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. Christina Malisoff was a activist. She worked at the Hudson Opera House the last 10 or 15 years, I guess. And she hosted Tell It Like It Is on WGXC. It was Thursdays at 10 a.m. when the station started every week. She also helped with Operation Unite, the started the Hudson Community Garden, worked with Animal Kind and WGXC. And there's going to be a celebration of Christina Malisoff's life Sunday, May 24th at 11 a.m. at the Hudson Opera House. You can bring a dish to share. And she's survived by her sister Dawn of Philadelphia and longtime friend and companion Doug Clow. That's all from the Hudson Opera House Facebook feed. If you want more information, that's where to go.
Good morning, everyone. This is Christina Malasoff, and this is another edition of Tell It Like It Is. Tell It Like It is on every Thursday morning on WGXC Community Radio from 10 to 11. And I'm very pleased to say that we are being joined by Ms. Dina Siddiqui. Ms. Siddiqui is a visiting associate professor from the Women and Gender Studies program at Hunter College, City University of New York. And we will be talking about the Tazreen factory fire, which occurred about a week ago in the capital of Bangladesh, and the implications of that and other issues relating to women and workers. So stay tuned for that. Okay, just wanted to check. Dina, are you with us?
Hello, yes, I am indeed.
Great, okay, and we can hear you clearly. Again, I want to thank you for coming on. Again, I want to say this is Dina Siddiqui. She is a visiting associate professor for Women and Gender Studies program at Hunter College at the City University of New York. And Dina has, Ms. Siddiqui has joined us today to talk, as I said, about the Tazreen factory fire, which is in Bangladesh. I wonder if we could just begin a little bit, Dina, you were saying that you actually had a background in labor studies in Bangladesh, or?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to talk about this. I think it's very important. It does have something to do with people's lives in the U.S., and there hasn't been that much. There's been something in the New York Times, but on the whole, in the media, there's been very little on this, so I really appreciate this opportunity. Let me just begin with the bare details of the fire. The fire itself was publicized quite widely. It started in Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka, in an industrial sector near the capital where there are many, many garment factories. Last November 24th, a fire started in this factory called Tazreen. The fire was caused by an electrical short circuit, and what happened was it started on the ground floor, and it spread up to nine stories of the factory. What made it really difficult for 112 people died, mostly women, but what made exit, saving workers, very difficult was that against regulations, the factory owners had stored large bales of fabric and yarn on the ground floor. There were three exits, three stairways down, and they all led into the place where the fire started. So it's impossible to save people, many, many people. There were horrific stories of people calling their loved ones and their cell phones from the top floors to say goodbye because they knew they would die. So it was quite awful. So basically all exits were blocked. And in fact, when the fire alarms first went off, workers were told by the management to go back to work. So you lost precious time there. So that was one of the main reasons why so many people died.
Yeah.
So that's the story.
You're right that there was a lot of reports on this, but the background of this horrifying story is what I'd like to get to, because this was not an isolated incident. Apparently, there was an. Could you talk about the fact that there were a number of other incidents of fires in factories in Bangladesh?
Absolutely. The fires in factories are actually a long-standing fact. I started doing my research almost 15, 20 years ago, and even at that time there were small fires. People died. They obviously didn't make international headlines. But by the time we had the Tazreen fire, 600 people had died together in fires over the last 20 years. And that's just from things that are totally preventable, part of the reason is that, not for the Tazreen fire so much, but it's standard procedure for factories to lock their doors at all times. And they do that so because they're so worried that workers will steal goods as they leave factories. And it's very much this mentality of the working class, you know, not being able to be trusted. Mm-hmm. I think that's in there. So it's everyday procedure. So very often when fires start, workers find that they're actually they're at locked exits that nobody is unlocking because the managers have already fled. So that's been actually quite a very bad thing. That's one of the background things. Now the government knows this. This is not new. The government, I just read a statement where somebody, the labor secretary, said this is a wake-up call, but it should have been a wake-up call a long time ago.
Right.
I'd like to introduce Christina Malisoff, another member of the Founding Radio Council and also an inspiration of mine and an activist in the area whose values and fortitude I truly admire.
Okay. Okay, welcome again, everyone. I just want to tell you I'm extremely nervous. I'm not a public speaker, and although I have a big mouth. And I also want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. And I also want to thank Kaya's tireless efforts in organizing not only this fundraiser, but many others. There's so many things that the last week I've been trying to write this thing down, and I don't have a computer, so it's really painful. So much paper wasted. But let me get right to it. WGXE 90.7 FM hands-on radio. That's what we're here about. When we, WGXE, first started going into the community to find out what people wanted to hear on community radio, the number one ask for a program was Democracy Now! And with the recent local elections, that's saying something considering how conservative an area we're living in. Democracy Now! Has been on the air since 1996 and has expanded its reach ever since. It can be heard on low-power FM, community and college radio stations, and over the internet and on cable, satellite TV. Not cable, but satellite TV. Can't read either, because I'm getting older. As a founding council member, and longtime listener to Democracy Now!, I felt that my most important goal being on the WGXC Council was to make sure that Democracy Now! Was included in our programming. Listening to Democracy Now! Is part of the daily routine and rhythm of my life, and as many others. It is now the cornerstone of WGXC's morning news programming and will be aired Monday through Friday, 8 through 9 a.m., once we are on the air. You can be... That's great. I'm having a hard time reading my writing. You can be informed about what's going on in the world while drinking your morning tea, changing the baby's diapers, or commuting to work. Democracy Now! Is an unembedded, or as Amy says, we are beholden to no one, quote unquote. That means no corporation, no arm of the military, no government can influence or censor the truth as it is reported. Democracy Now! Is where you will hear some of the experiences of people struggling against the destruction of their land and their environments that sustain them, and the environments that sustain them, such as the Ngoni people of the Niger Delta who are battling Shell Petroleum, to the people who suffer the brunt of the British Petroleum oil debacle in the Gulf of Mexico. It is perhaps the only voice of death row prisoners like Mumia Abu-Jamal or Troy Anthony Davis who are looking at execution by the state. It is the voice of dissidents, of the dissidents, the disappeared political prisoners from around the world. It is one of the few voices that exposes torture and extraordinary rendition. Democracy Now! Is where you will hear intellectuals from around the world talk about the most pressing issues of our times, such as climate change, privatization of world resources, distribution of wealth and power. You will be able to hear in-depth analysis and possible solutions from people like Vandana Shiva, Arundhati Roy, authors such as Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. I listen. You will hear intellectuals such as Noam Chomsky, and Right Livelihood Award winners such as Manfred Max Neef, an economist, Brazilian economist, or the recently passed Hermann Scheer, among many others. Democracy Now! Is also the voice of everyday people from communities around the world, such as this community, and their perspective of the effects of war, corrupt governments, and corporate greed on their communities. Democracy Now! Is one of the few news organizations talking about these issues. It is a news program that brings you the facts that are not corrupted by vested power. WGXC Hands-On Radio is glad to be able to give the people in our listening range of Columbia and Greene counties the opportunity to find out what is going on in the world simply by tuning in to Democracy Now! Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christina.
I'm playing songs to celebrate and mourn the loss of Christina Malisoff, who many of you know to have been a very significant, important person, inspiring person to all people, children, etc. in this community. She served them all well in a variety of different venues. And as I said before, she is one of the most professional people I think I've ever known. So we've all been on this long journey with Christina, and now it's time for us to leave her go along her journey. So I'm playing some songs that I feel best for me depict the way I knew her and how I related to her and what she meant to me in terms of the image, which in many ways was that of an angelic nature. So I'll be playing some songs to do with songs from my Angels playlist, which I played for you in the past. So I've got 5 or 6 songs here to do with the Angel experience. And then a couple of work songs, because Christina, as you know, was very interested in issues to do with the workforce and labor and minimum wage and workers' rights and those kinds of things.
I came to Hudson, and there were a good number of people on that first vigil. And I started coming back week after week, and we, I think, formed a community amongst ourselves of people that have stood and continue to stand on Saturdays. And the reactions we, you know, got in the beginning, I would call it, I'd say we got digitized. We'd get the middle finger, you know, from people.
Oh.
That was 11 years ago. Now we're getting a lot of honks and high fives and peace signs. And my question is, well, what's different today than it was 11 years ago? Yeah. My reason for standing out there is to try to raise consciousness, mm-hmm. to people to be aware. As Martin says, you know, it's not just our debt, it's other people's debt. Life, reverence for life, that's part of our, you know, and to bring that in.
Do you, when you talked about ultranationalism, the thing that comes to my mind is this: when you want to talk about a world without borders, then someone, the dead in another country, in a sense, are also, or people who are attacked in other countries, those are our brothers and sisters also. I don't see those delineations, but nationalism, if you can talk a little bit about that, the nationalism creates those borders or boundaries where people say, oh, that's them, or those are those people, and this is our country, and this is our people. And it seemed momentarily after 9/11 that those boundaries broke down. There were actually so many people in other countries who were so supportive of people in this country and what had happened at the Trade Center.
It was great for me to be invited to come on this show because I was able to do a lot of research. And I think that research and finding out about things in this world is how we're going to sort of improve our lot as human beings. But I just found a quote from Krishnamurti, I thought, you know, could really speak to this issue, Christine, if you don't mind. And this is his quote, and perhaps anybody who's listening would like to call in and comment. The phone number is will be given by Kieran right now, if you don't mind.
Oh,
sure, I'll give the phone number. Please call in. It is our pledge drive, and we're listening to our guests here on Tell It Like It Is, and we always encourage community participation. It's 518-828-0290. Give us a call and tell us what you think.
So Krishnamurti was born in 1895 and he died in 1986. This is a quote from him. When you call yourself an Indian or a Muslim or a Christian or a European or anything else, you are being violent. Do you see why it is violent? Because you are separating yourself from the rest of mankind. When you separate yourself by belief, by nationality, by tradition, it breeds violence. So a man who is seeking to understand violence does not belong to any country, to any religion, to any political party or partial system. He is concerned with the total understanding of mankind.
Martin, I'm so knocked out that you read that quote because I had no idea, and I've been reading Krishnamurti for years. But going beyond that, is this idea of defining ourselves as a particular group, and just immediately by doing that, it says that someone else is of a different group, and that right there is an act of violence, is saying that there's some kind of weird disconnect between you and I.
I think the I guess what you call dialectic is between being a person from a specific place and being a citizen of the world. Tolerance and diversity have to go hand in hand.
So, Martin, the idea of setting up this dialogue between yourself and the community, because let me preface this by saying that I've had Nancy Smith on the show, and for folks who don't know Nancy Smith, she's a member of the community who actually recently, within the last year, spent 6 months in a federal prison protesting the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, a school which trains soldiers from other countries who go back to those countries and do some pretty horrible things. And with U.S. training under their belt. She's on the show, and one of the things we talked about is how do you reach out to people who don't necessarily see things the way you see things? How do you open up that dialogue without ideology getting in the way?
Wow. You know, for me personally, I can only speak personally. It has a little bit to do with the self and the ego and what we put out into the world and whether we all think that we're right or wrong. When you meet somebody, is it important for you to actually tell them what you think or listen to what they have to say? So I think that one of the things that Bill, for instance, does is he has a sign, and the sign has a message. But on the other side of that sign is a statement saying, come and talk to me.
Yeah, and the reason I did that was, as I referred to earlier, we got these signs from people, and a way to respond to them. And usually it would happen so quick you couldn't do anything. So now I just flip the sign over, and although no one has come from that, they're usually passing by in a car, and they're gone. Yeah.
One of the most moving times that I had standing there was everybody else had left and I was there all alone. And this car comes screeching to a stop across from me. And this big burly guy gets out. And I'm thinking he's going to come and beat me up or something. And he comes over to me and he says, "I don't agree with you at all, but I respect your ability, your being able to stand out there. And that's what America's all about." So what we're trying to do is make a climate for involvement for political discourse, which is not us against them, but we finding answers to our problems together.
Martin, some people would argue that that the under the Obama administration, which I would say is not true, that we've had a closure of one war and we're slowing down on the next. This is what's being said. Why are you still out there? I mean, if you know. What do you feel like? What has changed in the last 11 years? And has there been a demilitarization or not of this country?
I think it's always there.
That's Bill speaking.
It goes on, especially with the drones, an issue that needs to be addressed. And although I do believe this administration is doing its best under the circumstances that it's been handed.
Well, yes, and we actually had Medea Benjamin on the show when she organized earlier in the spring convention talking about drone strikes and exactly like the secret war that's going on, that Obama personally has a list that he approves without trial of people in other countries who are being killed by these weapons. And the weapons not being all that accurate and actually killing a lot of collateral damage, which, Martin, you referred to. Again, words. Martin, can you talk about words like collateral damage and how those words can just synopsize a person's whole family or their life, you know, how all of a sudden they just become some kind of word and yet there was a real human being there before that?
I find it dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just doesn't make it a person mm-hmm. anymore.
What's up, everybody?
Dude, I'm so glad.
Yeah. I hope I don't cry.
It's going to be interesting.
Oh, my God. My mic's not up. I screwed up the first 2 minutes. Christina's laughing at me right now. She's like, dude.
Yeah, Nash, it's she would be happy, I think, with the realness of community radio that we're here.
Totally.
And, yeah, really, really, really sad day today, but. You know, I don't know, death, it just, like, never gets easier. I don't know, it just never, ever does for me. But anyway, I just wanted to be here with you today, Kieran, because we both worked with Christina a lot here at the radio station and in other ways. Of course, she was just an amazing community spirit for, you know, everyone in the community, and yeah. Anyway,
totally, man. I was like, I'm like looking.
I'm fumbling
everywhere.
With words.
That's cool. That's cool, man. Like about from the very beginning of the inception of WGXC, she was just pumped about community radio, about getting, you know, the unspoken, the voices that aren't normally heard, the voice of the voiceless. She was just like, this was her opportunity to get. You know, a lot of her, the issues she cared about in our, that a lot of us care about. I'm fumbling with words too. Rebecca, welcome to the show. We have Rebecca here with us who had no idea like what she was getting into today. She thought maybe going to talk about MK Ultra and maybe some alien abduction and stuff.
A little bit of conspiracy, but no, today is not the day for it.
Maybe not. Well, no. We might have some stories later on, but thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Of course. Good to be here. On such a rainy day.
Yeah.
The sky's crying too.
That's yep. right. It's a mourning day.
Yep.
So Christina Malisoff, she helped start this lovely radio station. She was pumped about it from the very beginning. Like Phil had said, on the advisory board, she was on the governing council, the council of WGXC, started a show that I actually joined her with called Tell It Like It Is, that you, I think, were the first co-host with her, no?
Yeah, we were. It actually came out of very early on, before the station was on the air. Dharma Daily was doing a workshop, and Christina got involved in that, which was helping to teach people how to produce radio shows. And so out of that workshop grew this idea that Christina really wanted to see a sort of a collective of people producing a show together, co-hosting a show, and came up with the idea of calling it Tell It Like It Is, and it would be directed at social justice issues, environmental justice issues, community issues. And so it was a kind of a really early thing that happened. It was one of the first organized shows that went on the air here at WGXC. And I got to say, it was fun, but it was also an intense amount of work every week.
Yeah.
We would be on the phone together like every day for at least an hour, figuring out the show, figuring out guests, lining up guests. Actually, it became, after a while, it was just a little bit too much work for me, and I had to drop out from it. And then I think that's around the time that you came into that scene, Karen.
I rolled in with tons of energy, and you're right, it was definitely very demanding. Well, she was just an intense individual. Let's just say it up front. She was just
fierce,
and she didn't put up with any BS from anybody, especially if you were a dude. She'd be like, what are you talking about? So as a dude, actually, I kind of felt honored to be like invited back every week onto her show.
Yeah.
Even though,
yeah,
you know, I tried not to do a lot of talking. She'd be like, shut up. Like,
yeah.
No, she was real passionate.
And she was a really good interviewer too. Because she was a good listener.
Yeah. Yeah, she'd get pumped up, like Medea Benjamin, when we invited we interviewed her, talk about drones and stuff, you know, from Code Pink, you know, Medea Benjamin getting arrested all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chris Hedges, that was another big one we did. That was interesting. Wow. Like Debbie Downer, Chris Hedges, like, but he was really good. Like, it was Occupy, I think it just started. No, this was right before Occupy.
Oh, so, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I heard that one. That was a good one.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember some of the other ones. It's just, I just heard the news today, actually. I don't go on Facebook, so I didn't know until today. But thanks for the call again. Let me know.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, just so much great interviews happened because of Christina, I think.
Yeah.
We would go to events all over the place, up and down the Hudson Valley, and then go meet the speakers at the events. We would be at Bard for something. Tim DeChristopher, we interviewed at Bard.
Yep.
Then Franklin Lopez, the director of NCIV, Resist or Die, and that was screening at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And so we went to that, and we got to meet him and interview him. You know, just, again, she was just fierce. She would go get the material.
Yeah.
She sounds amazing.
Yeah.
She was. I think you'd appreciate her, Rebecca. A lot of people appreciated her, and I think she was diagnosed with cancer probably about 10 years ago now. She was about 55 or 56 years old, I found out, and which I didn't know, because I always thought she was my age because she looked way better than me, like, for a variety of reasons. But, you know, it's just the youthfulness, and like, she had a hard life too. She grew up in the city and pretty... what she didn't talk about a lot, but, you know, pretty messed up circumstances. But she'd been through a lot in life.
Yeah.
She'd seen a lot.
Yeah.
And always kind of had those sparkly eyes and resilience regardless.
Yeah, and was, endlessly was generous too.
Yeah,
and
yeah, you know, even if she was having hard times or whatever, she'd like offer to buy me a falafel down at Bruno's. You know.
Oh yeah, like, totally. So. Yeah, I mean, she knew that I was looking for a job. I was out of work, and she found me a job, which I still now have 4 years later.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
4 years later,
she was just amazing in her generosity and, you know, caring for other people, for animals. You know, she did a lot of work at Animal Kind. I'm sure Katrine could come tell a lot of stories, Christina stories. I hope she will come do that on the air. But, yeah, and then, you know, I actually met Christina, like, when I first moved up here about 15 years ago, and she was a waitress at the Paramount restaurant, which doesn't exist anymore.
The Paramount.
I think that's where Daba is now.
Yeah, one of Hudson's ancient fixtures back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Before my time.
Yeah, the Paramount. It was like out of some 50s movie or something.
But it was just so great to meet her, and then conversation started, and we started learning how much we had in common and our outlooks, and, you know, quickly became friends from there.
Yeah.
And then, like, it was a few years later, she ended up working across the river at the Stewart House in Athens, where I live, and I hadn't seen her. I hadn't seen her in, like, a year or so, but I had heard her voice on WRPI.
Nice.
And like, I was like, that's that girl from the Paramount. And then I go to the Stewart House, and there she is working. And I'm like, hey, I heard you on the radio. And she's like, oh, yeah, I do a radio show at WRPI. You want to come on?
That's Christina.
You know, and she just always would have anybody come on the air anytime.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like me.
Yeah. Like, and then, yeah.
Come on the air.
Exactly. And then before you know it, she's like, hey, you want to just co-host?
Sweet.
Okay. So, again, my name is Christina Malasoff, joined by Kieran Riley. This is Tell It Like It Is. Every Thursday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC. WGXC Community Radio, hands-on radio. This is why we can do this. So support community radio. This is your voices. Make them heard. And we're joined this morning by Ed Kinane. Ed Kinane, if I can, will be joining us to talk about drones. Ed is from Syracuse, New York. He's been long committed to nonviolence and social justice. Ed is a retired educator. He used to teach math and biology in a one-room Quaker school in rural Kenya, and anthropology in a community college near Seattle. He is also a writer of letters to the editor, op-eds, articles, and reviews. Off and on since the 70s, he has been the editor of the Syracuse Peace Council's Peace Newsletter. In February 2003, Ed joined the Voices Iraq Peace Team, remaining in Baghdad throughout shock and awe until the invasion's end. In August of 2003, he returned to Baghdad with Voices for 10 weeks to help monitor the occupation. Back in the States, Ed has worked against the U.S. occupation of Iraq and has spoken to many classes and congregations and communities about his Iraq experience. And he's here today to speak to you, the people in Columbia and Greene counties and the outer environs, about drones. So let's see if we can get Ed on the line. Hold on. Ed, are you
with Christina?
Great, Ed. So everything's working today so far.
Except for me, I'm not at the moment. Thank you for joining us, Ed.
Hi, my pleasure, Kieran.
So, Ed, I found you on the internet because after listening to the report of what was going on with this amazing international protest in Pakistan, a group of people who were actually trying to go to Waziristan, which is an outer province in northwest Pakistan, I believe. I wanted to find someone who was connected to the sister protest here in upstate New York. Can you tell us a little bit about what that protest was, both in Pakistan and the one in New York State, and how you were involved.
Sure. I wasn't in Pakistan for this event, but I think it's an historical event in which about, as I understand it, about 30 folks from the U.S. Took part in this delegation in March, organized by Code Pink, a woman-inspired anti-war social justice group nationally. And of those 30, like a half a dozen are from upstate New York. You may know Joe Lombardo over in the Albany area.
Yes.
And we have folks from Buffalo and Ithaca as well. So they went over October 3rd through 10th and met with important figures in the society and politics there. And then for a couple of days, they marched toward the area that's particularly vulnerable to U.S. Reaper drone terrorism. And when I say terrorism, I mean that these Reaper drones with their Hellfire missiles and their 500-pound bombs have killed many civilians, have maimed many civilians, and have displaced tens of thousands of civilians just out of the fear and the terror that these Reaper drones reap on the people there. So they wanted to show that U.S. people care about this and are aware of it and are struggling against it.
Ed, in preparation for this show, and I didn't mean to cut you off, I want you to finish your thought, but I've had a number of people ask me to please, in detail, explain what a drone is and
yes.
what it's capable of doing.
All right. Sure,
thank you.
Good question. A drone is an aerial vehicle. It looks kind of like an airplane, but there's no crew on board. It's a robot. And you have a technician, often in the United States, using a computer and a joystick that's guiding that robot to do its surveillance and to do its deadly duties. Now here, I'm in Syracuse. On the edge of Syracuse is Hancock Air Base. And that base is a Reaper hub in our region. So usually it's a young technician sits at a console, computer console, and is able to guide these Reapers over in Pakistan or Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen or Somalia or perhaps other countries like Libya. And then from the comfort of his or her chair is able to rain death and destruction on people whom this technician, you know, doesn't even speak the language, doesn't know the culture, and doesn't know the circumstances of the people that he or she is killing. This is terrorism, and it's happening right here in central New York, upstate New York, right just a few miles from where I'm sitting right now here in Syracuse. It's the computer is linked to a satellite, and then from the satellite, the signal goes down to the actual Reaper in the air.
So is there a high margin of error with these things? Are they as accurate as they purport them to be, that they can just, you know, protect U.S. lives, U.S. troop lives by just going in and taking out a particular terrorist? I mean, there's issues with that because, you know, who's a terrorist and who's decided that they're on the hit list? But we can get that
right.
to that later. But there's been a lot of Code Pink's talk a lot about civilian casualties. Can you give us an idea of, first of all, the accuracy of these drones, number one? Number two is how do we have a sense of how many civilians have been harmed by this?
Okay, accuracy. I think if you had an immobile, inanimate target on the ground, a small target, you could hit that target with a drone, probably with a pretty high degree of accuracy. The problem is that a human being isn't just the same thing as a test target on the ground. Human beings live with other human beings. They travel with other human beings. And if you have a target, it's very likely you'll not only kill that person, but those in the surrounding area. And how do you know that person is the right person? Because some informant on the ground who has an axe to grind against that person, you know, tells you he's the person to kill? I mean, it's very iffy. The intelligence on the ground is very iffy. very few U.S. people, U.S. military, know the local languages. And they certainly don't know the local cultures. They don't know the local power structures and struggles. So getting good intelligence is a very major problem. So for every maybe high-level Al-Qaeda or Taliban victim, dozens of other people may be killed. This is, you know, against international law. It's against our conscience. I mean, some of us are raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition, which says, thou shalt not kill. It's time we take that seriously. It's immoral and it's illegal. Also, it leads to blowback. In other words, it does more harm than good for the U.S. strategically. The drone is very clever tactically, but it's strategically stupid. It leads to blowback. I mean, for every person killed, there are survivors. Mm-hmm. There's relatives, there's neighbors, mm-hmm. there's friends, there's associates. Mm-hmm. They develop a strong hostility toward the U.S. And with time, that hostility can play itself out against U.S. people and U.S. Installations, both abroad and here in the U.S., maybe. So it's a very risky business. And it does not make us here in the U.S. safer, or people in general safer.
How does it work that we can actually go into countries that we're not actually, that we've never declared war with, such as Pakistan, Yemen, and use these drones? How does that work?
Well, it's the arrogance of power. I mean, the United States is the one superpower on the planet. It devotes an enormous amount of its economy to militarism, to military weaponry. No other power could stand before us militarily. So we have the right of bullies. It's wrong. It's going to be very harmful to the U.S. in the longer run. But the people in power in the United States and the power structure, many of them gain by these perpetual wars the U.S. is engaged in. You know, particularly the corporations, you know, the military corporations, gain enormous profits from this sort of thing. And, of course, it's the military corporations, the war corporations, that do a lot of funding of our candidates.
Ed, just another quick question about the use of drones and the widespread. Now, President Bush initiated the program. I think he had a few drones. They added a few towards the end of his presidency, and then he had a few drone strikes towards the end of his presidency, I believe,
right.
All in Pakistan. Obama has now, I think, done that times like 600 or something. Mm-hmm. It's been like... And I've also heard a statistic that the drone program now makes up a one-third of the entire Air Force fleet of aircraft, and that they are extremely expensive to operate, maintain. Is this proliferation going to continue, and why do they use them so extensively if they're that much more less cost-efficient? You know, because they're always looking at cost efficiency, or so they claim.
Well,
sorry
they
about the term.
I think cost efficiency is rather less important compared to, say, profits for corporations.
Right.
But the drone itself is pretty cheap compared to, say, a jet fighter plane. You know, a drone might be $10 million, whereas a fighter plane, you know, might be, I mean, I don't know the figures, maybe $100 million, just plucking a figure out of the air. So at one level, drones are far cheaper than, say, F-16s. But in order to operate those drones, there's an enormous amount of infrastructure, personnel, that need to back up those drones. And that gets pretty expensive.
Okay, so you got these guys behind computers basically playing video games somewhere up in Hancock,
right.
New York. Creech Air Force Base, is that another one out in Denver?
No, that's out in Nevada.
Nevada?
Near Las Vegas.
Okay, and now just could you talk a little bit about what it means for soldiers to be killing people remotely through their computers? As far as, you know, we have a lot of history and statistics and research done into PTSD with our soldiers returning veterans.
Right.
Talk about maybe a little bit of the difference between killing remotely and is there still PTSD, or is there certain conditions, are you aware of, that veterans that operate these drones go through?
Apparently there is PTSD among some drone technicians. And this is easily explained because the surveillance in these Reaper drones is really extraordinary. And so the operator of the drone in Creech Air Base or in Hancock Air Base really sees the demolition happen. I mean, he sees the bomb strike. He sees people fleeing from the scene. He sees body parts. It's a horrendous thing to see. Now, if you were the pilot of, say, an F-16, by the time your bomb would hit the ground, you may be several miles beyond, and you certainly don't see what you've done. So seeing this probably has a strong impact on some of these technicians. In fact, I understand that Creech Air Base had to hire, like, more chaplains and counselors and so forth to deal with these, the troubles that these technicians were having.
Yeah, so there's basically...
Also, there's kind of a disconnect. Let's say you're out of Hancock Air Base in suburban Syracuse, and you work your shift, 8 or 10 or 12 hours or whatever it is. Then you go home to another suburb, and you're with your spouse, you're with your kids, you're having your barbecue. You're not in a combat world or a combat situation, although you're very busy killing people. For some people, that apparently is a difficult transition to make on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, I just...
Talk about your work.
Bringing up the fact that, and I am so personally grateful to WikiLeaks for, some of the exposés, particularly the film showing a civilian reporter and being killed by helicopter, getting of permission, all done legally, and in fact,
okay,
according to them. But I want to go back, Ed, though, to the use of drones, because I keep hearing about families getting wiped out, weddings, and also just this idea of getting supposedly middle-level Taliban or Al-Qaeda people. What is that gaining us? Are these drones really that accurate? Can they take out one person, or do they wind up? We had Medea Benjamin on the show months earlier in the spring, I believe, and she talked about their heat, how they're guided into a particular person, and how they. I think if you're carrying a weapon, they just go for anybody with a weapon, which could be anybody, because I think in the provinces a lot of people carry weapons. If it's hunting season now in upstate New York, if you're carrying your gun going for your doe, could you accidentally be hit by a drone? I don't know.
In these regions that are so wild and woolly, if you will, the standard operating procedure, at least for males, to be carrying guns. So does that mean they're an enemy of the United States? I don't think so. It's ludicrous.
Yeah, for anybody listening who might just be tuning in, we're dedicating this show to our dear friend Christina Malisoff, who passed on this weekend after a long illness, and was just a great, fierce community warrior, lover, impacted a lot of people. Kieran and I were really fortunate to work with her here at the radio station and in other ways. So, just living on with all of her great work and efforts. She would not want anybody to really be getting too down over it, but just moving on and keeping up the good work.
Yeah, and staying goofy all along, she had a goofy side too, and we goof around, so
guys, like fart jokes and all kinds of stuff.
She was a trip. And she was a real fighter too. She was like a tough little bird, and that's why when I heard the news and Sam called me, it actually kind of hit me kind of really hard, partly because I didn't think it would come down to this. I thought that she'd pull through and
Because she's just such a strong, strong person. That's what I thought too.
Yeah.
Like,
well, she is. She was. But like, when you're deep into it, she had cancer. She'd been fighting for a while. She was doing chemo treatments. She was trying to stay away from the chemo treatments, but had to resort to a lot of chemo, which also kicks your butt simultaneously as the cancer. So both just she kind of succumbed and.
She did fight it for a long time, though.
Yeah.
I mean, she did.
And she looked so good most times when I see her on the street. I saw her down in Rhinebeck, actually, with a little dog, Feather.
Mm-hmm.
And her dog would actually be here in the studio doing Tell It Like It Is, like up against the microphone with her as she was hosting.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny. But she just always looked so vibrant. And
always styling, too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, girl had style.
Yeah.